Can you hear me? Well, it's a bit strange for me to be introducing people, regularly introduce me, and I'm not going to talk about my own daring deeds or daring do, but about a man. This is the man who is responsible for all of you being here. He is the creator of Star Trek. He's brought a lot of happiness to you and to thousands of others all over the world. I think the Star Trek fan clubs are universal and probably the biggest fan club in the world. All due to one man, the creator of Star Trek. Now, you know Gene's history through the program, so I'm not going to talk about that. I'm just going to say one or two words about the man himself. He is probably one of the warmest, kindliest, and most generous human beings I have ever known. And he's proved it many a time all over the world. Both he and Maisel, his lovely wife, I cannot say enough about them. And I've known them for a long time, and every time I see them, I feel happier. Now, I first met Gene some years ago. I was introduced to him by my brother, who was over here at the time. And within a few minutes, we knew that we were going to make it because we had a common interest, and that was the naval history of England during the Napoleonic Wars. I suppose quite a number of you know all about them too. Oh, I don't mean that you were there. But anyhow, Gene and I fought many a battle, especially the battles of Captain Horn. Of course, we won them all. And at that time, we were both thinking that what a good thing it would be if we could bring to life probably some of these old naval battles that were fought with far more terrific violence than one would have today, I can assure you. But anyhow, that's an impossibility, so we've talked them over instead. This is all really I have to say, because I cannot say enough about Gene or Major. I love them both. So now I'm going to introduce you, or reintroduce you, to the great bird of the galaxy. Gene.
As you might gather, with a gentleman like this, you learn the meaning and the importance of things like good, dear, and true friend. And it's really great to have. These comments I'm going to make today that may interest you are much like these comments are much the same as I gave at the World Future Society in Washington a couple of months ago. And someone said, well, what? You're going to talk to Star Trek fans the same way you talk to gathered scientists and all of this? And I said, of course you do. This is these are people who are truly interested in the future and truly interested in humanity and in ideas. These comments I'm going to include with the bloopers, And so it'll go on a little longer than the hour that we've talked about. And so the question-answer period perhaps won't be as long as you'd like, but I told the committee that I will make myself available sometime tomorrow for another question-and-answer session. So those of you who don't get a question-answer today about whatever, well, we'll do it then. I think first I should start with a confession, which is that I'm always a little nervous that my taking a speaker's platform like this might suggest to people that I think that Star Trek was some sort of inspired vision of the future. In his novel, 1984, George Orwell suggests that every human being has one great secret fear. And mine is that my friends and associates might think I bed down every night in space admiral pajamas. In fact, I did accept the invitation to come here and to speak here. It commemorates some advice given to me by your Arthur C. Clarke many years ago. It happened in summer of 1969, 10 weeks after the Star Trek series had been canceled because of consistently low audience ratings. And it was considered a failed series. And so having become unemployed, well, I was able to attend an Arizona astronomy university astronomy session where Arthur was the principal speaker. And Clarke, of course, I'm sure almost everyone here knows, is the author of great novels like Childhood's End and Space Odyssey 2000, or 2008 Space Odyssey, I guess is probably what it was, and as well as being a brilliant scientist and inventor in his own right. And he also knew a great deal about the limitations of commercial television in America. So I could hardly believe my ears at this meeting when I heard him from the platform congratulating me and us on what we had managed to accomplish during our 3-year Star Trek run. And this was a rare moment for me because, as I said, Star Trek has been labeled as by American television industry as an expensive and childish failure. And I told Clarke that no advertising company had shown any interest in even purchasing at that time a first rerun of it. And I remember Arthur smiling and pointing out to me that in the time between Star Trek had been canceled and this Arizona astronomy meeting, humans had landed on the moon. A human had walked on the surface of another world. And Arthur said he doubted very much that audiences would still be considering space travel to be a foolish fantasy. During which we were interrupted by a professor from another university, and he, with an invitation to lecture at another university, all expenses paid, a very nice fee. And when I realized he was talking not to Arthur, but to me, I could not have been more shocked if he had been inviting me to come sleep with his wife. And as I was attempting to politely decline the offer, a change sort of came over Clarke. A moment ago, he'd been a nice English gentleman who was congratulating me on our series, and now he was demanding to know why I was refusing to extend my horizons. And did I believe that my show business haunts of Hollywood and New York, and Arthur can make that sound like Sodom and Gomorrah, if I believe they were somehow the center of the world? And so I found myself cornered into agreeing that I would accept at least a dozen college and other lectures every year. Meanwhile, wondering, you know, what dozen lectures? Clarke may be a great futurist in some areas, but I was thinking, boy, he's really a cuckoo in this one. And the P.S., of course, is that in less than a year, Star Trek reruns had become a show business phenomenon. And a major lecture agency was handling me at Arthur's request. And I have been indebted to him ever since it was because of his advice that forced me into becoming an active part of the exciting diversity and the exciting ideas in this world of ours. And the current example is, of course, my being here with you. Since the beginnings of our being together here today was science fiction, I thought you might like to hear me talk about science fiction in a very personal way. For example, do I believe that science fiction charts the future for science? It is true, of course, that artists, in my case, popular dramatists, can ride imagination to a lot of places that science will one day go. And so in that sense, science fiction does predict many future things. But it rarely does it in very close accuracy. Example, Jules Verne. He did carry us down under the sea and open human thought to the fact that we could and will someday do that. But if we tried to use Jules Verne's submarine example, we would be drowned in about 3 minutes. I'm going to move now into some Star Trek subjects that I've never talked about before a group of Star Trek fans, and certainly not to any Star Trek convention. I'm entering into these subjects because my very special affection for you, and for you island pirates, and because I think you and I know you and I share the same bloodlines, and of course we are much more important, some of the same ideals. So I'm going to be completely honest. Never for one moment did I ever believe that anything like the Starship Enterprise and Captain Kirk and his crew would be out there going from star to star in 3 centuries. We won't reach the stars that soon. Will we eventually go out to the stars? Yes, I have no doubt of that. I think we're an incredible creature. But our space vehicles then, and even more importantly, ourselves, we humans, will be far, far different from anything we can imagine right now. And certainly far different from anything that you could get onto a television screen and get a television audience to identify with. Yet meanwhile, though, it does make sense to have Star Treks. And it does make sense for you folks to identify with these and for others to, and for me to identify with it as I did. Because at our present level of evolution, we humans tend to think in terms of images. And a Captain Kirk and his crew and his USS Enterprise is an image that we can handle easily. And an image that allows us to think about that future. Why won't we go to the stars right away? Well, there's very exciting reasons. For one thing, we humans are going to be very, very busy for the next few centuries ahead, just in handling the enormity, the wealth, the challenges we have right here in our own solar system. Out there we have many thousand, million miles to explore in this wonderful backyard of ours. And this, and you know, as you know, it includes 7 other planets, or 8 or 9. Or maybe one we haven't discovered yet. And enough material and energy to, and challenges to keep us busy for hundreds of years. Unless you have dabbled in astronomy, you cannot realize how much unimaginably further away the stars really are. As for Kirk and his starship crew, I had no choice but to design them as familiar 20th century types, complete with 20th century morals, 20th century values, and interests. The date might have been the 23rd century, but you must understand that a science fiction writer writes, he plays it for a 20th century audience, and that audience must be able to identify it. If I had given Kirk and the others the values and the looks that I suspect 23rd century humans will really be like, I think it would have either angered or scared the pants off the television audience. And you can easily prove that to yourself. Here's a way you can do it. Things are changing much faster now, so let's imagine bringing somebody that distance ahead into our century. Things would change between now and the 23rd century so fast, you have to move all the way back to the 10th century to really get that much change between them now. But if you can imagine dipping into the 10th century and bringing someone from those times into our time with bikinis and the kind of language we have and television with its car crash chases and punk rock and things. A person from the 10th century would have no choice but to believe they had died and gone to hell. That's how great the changes were then, and that's how great the changes will be ahead. So you have no choice but to think in those terms. I have no choice but to write in these present day terms. But again, I insist to you, there's nothing improper about thinking of it in terms that I can relate to and write in it, and you can relate to in understanding it and in celebrating it. Before we move into the excitement of how fast things are happening, and wow, I tell you, this is so exciting, how fast things are changing now. I think that it may be time to enjoy what I consider to be the most civilized of all human attainments, and that is sense of humor. So if the projectionist is ready, and we can get the screen ready up here, before I go any further, I want to relax for a moment now. I brought the best copy of the bloopers that is in existence, and we're going to... So we're going to run the first half of it now, and then later on we'll run the second half. I was wondering why the screen was there for just me to look at.
As inanimate objects do.
Why do I show these with the serious parts of the speech? And for a very good reason. I'll be talking about us going out there, but I'll tell you one thing. If we don't take our human things, like our sense of humor, out there with us, it won't be worth the trip. Really, do you agree?
We've got to do that.
We did show these bloopers once to an audience that never cracked a smile. I'll come out here. So this goes here. Part of it. And this... this was an audience of network officials. And well, I think it indicates that there is something to the saying that sense of humor and intelligence go together. Let's see, I was coming in on how fast... Everything around us is changing. And here's what has been happening, really. In about the year 1961, we humans reached a point where we began doubling our knowledge every 7 years. Some estimate it is a little faster, some a bit slower, but it happens that 1961 is approximately the time we began doubling the scientific papers we published every 7 years. And let's explore what a mind-bender this really is. Using the 7-year doubling rate, please imagine with me that back in 1961, we took all the knowledge human beings had up to that time, which was quite a bit. We had the beginnings of the space program, television, quite a few things. And let's say we built a huge library to hold all of that knowledge in 1961 library terms. We would have had to build, and I'm sure you realize, an enormous structure, probably with square miles in floor space. In 1968, of course, knowledge would have doubled, and we would have needed two of these libraries, but here is where it begins to get interesting. In the year 1975, knowledge doubled again. It took us, in that time, into the genetics revolution, into mini-micro-surgery, circuitry, and much more. Doubling the knowledge then in two libraries would have required four such libraries. 7 years later, 1982, knowledge again doubled, a host of incredible new things. came to his mind, including things that completely changed our view about ourselves, where we came from, and the life and the beginnings of life form on this planet and so on. Some nice things happened too about that time. Things like sexual equality. And was finally, after long too far time, began to happen. And lovely things like parking and ramps for the handicapped to get into public building and parking areas for them. We didn't have that before then. So if that kind of knowledge and understanding keeps doubling and redoubling, why, we may be offering to our children really one hell of a great world. In 1982, accumulated knowledge then would have required double 4 or 8 of those incredible libraries. We humans increased our knowledge an incredible 8 times in just 21 years. Is that exciting? You're damned right it is. That is more than we increased our knowledge in the previous 2 centuries. That's what's happening to us. 7 years from then, 1989, which is only 5 years from now, we will double our knowledge to 16 times what it was in 61. 7 more years, 1996, 32 times what it was in 61. And hell, some of you will not be middle-aged by then. As a matter of fact, you will not be considered middle-aged at that time until you're well into your 60s. And you'll be enjoying sex through your 90s, and that is my good news for tonight.
Miss Wendy Downs, kindly contact reception to take a telephone call. Miss Wendy Downs to reception. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, is it possible to keep learning at that rate? Isn't there a limit to what our minds can absorb? Well, this brings us into the lovely mystery of our brain, and particularly the cerebrum part of our brain, that magical, it's a grapefruit-sized part of our brain that you could hold in your cupped hands. It contains something like 20 billion signal-generating and transmitting neurons, 20 billion, with each of them having the capacity of passing signals on 8 different ways. The mathematics of that is you have in your minds the potential of thoughts equal to slightly more than the number of stars in our galaxy. That is what we're capable of. We can't even dream of computers that can do that for another century. Neither is there a limit in sight to the doubling and redoubling of knowledge because of some things that are happening. More and more efficient ways of storing and transmitting that knowledge one to the other. And the best example of that, of course, is the computer, which back in exactly 10 years ago, I went to the prestigious Carnegie Mellon Institute to give a lecture, and I said then that their computers in 10 years would be as common in a household as a hot water heater, and the audience giggled. Today, you cannot get in Carnegie Mellon as a student unless you own a computer terminal. That's what's happening. The computer is not just a high-tech gadget. It is a primal invention. A human society changing thing, as was the wheel, written language, the printing press. The computer represents a completely new language and communications and even thinking system. It works at the speed of light. Last year I attended a convention which the Hughes Corporation transmitted the entire Encyclopedia Britannica in less than a minute. And equally incredible is the amount of information and minute detail which a computer still operating at near light speed velocity can handle, seek out, arrange, and organize. The last primal invention of this sort was something new, particularly in this region of England, should know something about. It was the engine-powered machine. Some people in those days were so afraid of these giant steam-driven noisy machines that they were afraid of them as some of us are of the computer. And they were saying things like, if God meant for us to have wheels, why did he give us feet? Well, you could press down on the accelerator pedal, dummy. The computer, ladies and gentlemen, and this cannot be a dry subject to you, because wow, everything you are and will become is changing because of it. The computer is the next magnitude of wonder. Just as the machine magnified muscle power, the computer amplifies human mind power. In other words, the computer amplifies the most powerful thing in existence. The computer alone is a guarantee that this present torrent of change will keep up. And of course, humanity is now expanding itself beyond this earth, moving out from this ancestral egg of ours. And we will, because the shell is already cracked. It is as certain we will move into space as it was certain a couple of centuries ago that we would eventually discover, colonize, and make use of the new world down here. And for many of the same reasons. One of which is that every pound you invested in opening up the new world has been returned something like 100 million times over in various ways. All the money invested in getting up there will be returned billions of times over to us humans. Our solar system, this backyard we've been getting up there, is incredibly rich in energy, material. In a novel that I'm currently writing, the main character said something to me, and characters do talk to authors, which may be what makes us a little strange. But he cautioned me, actually, that our life form will be able to travel only as far out into space as we are able to, far outer space as we are able ourselves to travel into inner space. He claims that one of the universe's natural laws, as much a law as a law of gravity or anything else, requires that we're to go further and improve and evolve before we go too far out there. If true, that could explain why our solar system up there is such a treasure house. Perhaps it explains also why it contains no other life forms. Have you ever thought of that? In this next new world exploration we're going to do out there, we got no Indians who've got to put up their land, or Hawaiians, and I think that is great. I've never been disappointed that we didn't discover life in this solar system. The character in my novel believes that it was arranged this way purposely. It is designed to keep us busy, growing, improving ourselves, exploring our own inner space, until the point is reached where it is safe for us to go out to stars, at which point we will not then interfere and hurt the life forms we will find in those billions of suns and the solar systems surrounding those suns out there. So we've got some time now to grow up here. Where do science fiction writers and dramatists come onto ideas like that? I'd like to briefly demonstrate something I've never heard of being done before an audience like this before. As one who specializes in fiction, I would like to introduce you here from this platform to a pair of fictional characters and show you how they come into being and how they become real and how they even help shape a dramatist's thoughts. I'm limiting this demonstration to just two fictional characters, because when a dramatist deals with a full stories collection of characters, they begin crowding his mind, in annoying ways, demanding more and more from us, demanding that each of them be given life's challenges and successes and joys and failures and pains and motivations, to the point that we find ourselves, a dramatist finds himself totally exhausted. And I find myself pitying God, who's got even more characters praying and demanding more. And leaves me usually to sit puzzling over a glass of scotch, wondering how an omniscient he, she, or it got itself caught in such a terrible trap. Joining me first at this podium is a very old friend, Mr. Spock. And I can see him now, even though you can. It is my business to see him. And I thought thought you might be interested in just how we first became acquainted back in 1965. A writer who works with any pride and any care goes to much effort in creating every character, and especially one that is unusual or complex in any way. How many of you have tried writing stories of any type here today? Oh, hello, all you know what I'm talking about then, great. The way I investigate a character like that, and when that character becomes born for me, I take sheets of paper, I divide them down the middle. On one side, I put my questions, and on the other side, I write the character's answers. And a strange thing happens. The answers begin coming easier and easier and easier. They reach a point they become easier than you can think of questions. And in the case of Mr. Spock, I have these notes at home, and this is taken from them. The first question I began with, and I usually do with every character, is, "What is your name?" And I reached out and wrote, "Mr. Spock." Depending on the character, this process can run into hundreds of pages. And you write much stuff that never appears in the script, because you've got to know that person in order to know how that character will react to every situation. If Mr. Spock seemed alive to you ever, this is why, because we had this background information. To any writers here now that care to try this, I do advise patience. If you have a truly interesting character, an intriguing one, stay with this technique. And a day will come when the character begins, swear, asking you questions. With Spock, after a few days of basic questions, I realized that all the answers were, if you forgive me, logical. So I really decided to try for some science fiction biggies, and so I looked ahead in the notes at home, and one of the first of those questions was, it was this: Roddenberry, the universe, where did it come from?
Not a bad question, huh?
Spock: considering its size and complexity, whatever created it has to be far beyond even a Balkan's comprehension. And I kind of like that. Sound like, you know, modest, sound like someone I could live with. He got very difficult later on. But during that, I must have scribbled something in which I used the word God. And my notes show Spock corrected it, calling it, "Its proper name is the consciousness." At which point I was beginning to ask myself, you know, what's happening? My character is telling me what to call God? Writers, you know, that does happen, don't you? Roddenberry, what is the universe for? What is its function? And I was rather pleased with myself for thinking of that question, because it's a question few people really ever ask. What is the universe for? And I noticed Spock seemed to be hesitating, so I tried suggesting something like, maybe God had some free time on his hands, 6 days to be exact. I swear to you, as friends, honestly, I could see Spock there raising that eyebrow, which is incredible because we haven't even invented that look yet. So I, Roddenberry, okay, smart ass, have you got an explanation? Which, of course, he had. He tells me that the universe is a gigantic life and intelligent producing mechanism. And this was such a nice science fiction idea, I added it to my notes and used it. A year or two later, I also learned that some very highly respected scientists and philosophers, and even some ancient Eastern philosophies, have said things exactly like that. So obviously I must have read them somewhere and forgotten them, because I refuse to believe that a fictional character that I've created is going to tell me things that I don't know. Although dramatists work in different ways, we all tend to think out our ideas in terms of people and dialogue. In the case of Spock, he and I kept talking for months, and we went into some subjects that never appeared on Star Trek, and the subjects like the possibility that this great consciousness was a growing thing, rather than being static, as God figures have always been thought of, but a growing consciousness. And that we got into some conversations where was it possible that what we call our consciousness is actually a piece of that great consciousness. And even questions like, is it possible that the way that great consciousness grows is that a piece of it is in every living, intelligent thing, not only here, but in every solar system, every intelligent life form in every galaxy across all the universe? If so, my God, what an incredible growing rate that would have to be. And what a beautiful way to grow, to invent every possible kind of situation and see how different types of forms react to it. What kind of a nut sits up in his home office every night talking to a character he invented? My wife would call, "Honey," or, "What are you doing up there?" And I would say, "Working." And I think perhaps I was. How is it? This is not new to dramatists and artists. How is it that invented people can seem to be sensible, helpful, even seem at times to contain a certain kind of wisdom? Is there a mystical or metaphysical answer for this? No, I think not. I think what I've just described is simply a process of using imagination to tap new ways of using our brain, or using new and different kinds of logic circuits. We humans are capable, really, of so much more than we know we're capable of. It might interest you on that line, as I was asked after describing this at the World Future Convention, to come out to Scripps Institute in California, where a group of University of California San Diego professors and NASA scientists were in, were asked to repeat it. We had a long session on this very question, because it is becoming apparent to science that science alone, thinking in logical ways and being curtailed, as scientists often are, they can lose a career and reputation if they speculate too wildly, only see part of the horizon ahead. The artist, being free to imagine, in fact he's supposed to imagine wildly, sees another part, and the two of them together give you a larger view of what we are and where we're going. So, and an exciting subject. It is an exciting subject. You hear a great deal more about it. We humans have more types of wisdom than we know. But I think what I've done now is to admit that my characters have more imagination than I have. And let's stop now at this point and see the rest of the bloopers. What makes our bloopers world famous and so enjoyable to you, I think, is the intelligence of our actors. Oh, before I go any further now, let me say something I sometimes forget to say. It says, you know, on Star Trek, created by Gene Roddenberry. That's very nice, and I enjoy it, and I sometimes take bows for it. The fact is that what I created was an outline. I had behind me these intelligent actors, directors, all sorts of behind-the-camera people that also created these things. The only thing I did was to give it a certain unity. I said yes or no. But show business is somewhere where, is the only place really where a committee ever creates anything. The committee needs a strong chairman, but it really is a lot of people's work. I remember Spock came to me, and he said, real early in the show, he said, "I felt that I need some sort of a Vulcan signal or something." And he told me a story about when he was a small boy in a Hebrew school, or in church, in the synagogue. The priests would come out and bless them on certain days. It was Orthodox synagogue, and they warned the children, "Don't look, or God might put your eyes out." But Leonard Nimoy, being Leonard Nimoy, took a peek. And he saw the priest doing this with the blessing. This is actually an old Hebrew sign. And he said, "Would you have any objection if I use this?" And the thought of my southern kinfolk going around giving each other Hebrew blessings. I said, "Yeah, man, go." So, we're going to see the second half. Oh, my favorite one is in this. Kirk and Spock are standing there looking at a viewing screen on which an enemy space vessel is supposed to go past. Unknown to them, the camera crew, having gotten bored, slipped in a picture of a nude woman. Watch how they handle it. Ladies and gentlemen, the second half of the bloopers.
Finishing up, I
met the next character I'll briefly talk about. The same way, the divided page, what is your name? And he told me his name was Gaan, G-A-A-N. And for almost a year and a half now, dialogue with him has become so valuable to me that in areas of futurism, I've been attempting to jump beyond the split page system with him and practice seeing the world through Gaan's eyes, his perception. And why go to all that trouble? We'll find out and understand as I tell you something about what Gaan is. Gaan was originally a very highly civilized and intelligent creature in his own body, a marine life form. Comes from a methane sea planet, which is why I call it it, because they're also unisexual. They only have one sex on the planet, one gender. His profession is scholar, and his specialty as a scholar is the study of life forms on other planets. And they study life forms in a very non-intrusive way that I think perhaps some many, many centuries ahead, we humans ourselves might be able to learn to do. Without revealing themselves, they learn the language and customs and all of that of a planet they're studying. And then when they're ready, they make a replica of that life form, and then they are capable of putting their own consciousness in that replica. And what better way to study another life form than to walk among them as one of them? My novel, Gaan has come to this planet in something the same way, and they have an emergency with their vessel, and Gaan has to decide very quickly whether to try this on this planet without knowing that much about them. The thing that makes it possible to do it is they have discovered, they wouldn't have had time to go down to the planet and replicate one of us, but they've discovered in the same orbit as them a frozen, dead human being. Crossed its chest by the initials CCCP. In other words, a Russian cosmonaut lost in a space accident up there. And my novel has gotten us that far. Gaan has meanwhile examined the planet and has just been absolutely shocked to find that on the dry crust of a planet, a life form has intelligence. It's an ugly thing. It totters around on spindles rather than being a smooth thing that travels through the water. And its top orifice is pierced with holes, moist, ugly holes. He feels toward us rather like we feel toward a tarantula spider. But it's a perfectly preserved body they found, and again, cannot resist the opportunity, even in an emergency, without knowing too much about this planet, of having this duplicated on his ship, because they have a very advanced civilization, science, and putting his consciousness into it and have it deposited down here on our planet. And now I call him because it was a male body. I doubt if I can adequately describe to you the fun I've had in trying to see the world through the eyes of a highly intelligent alien who has no connection with us, no prejudices for or against anything we do. Some people have. There are a couple of groups of fans now in the United States who do this same thing, as they do sort of a small party. They meet at the house, six or eight of them, then they go out to various places, separate, and watch humans. Then they come back and over glasses of wine describe what they've seen these creatures doing. And it's a real crazy way to look at ourselves. This is such an excellent technique. This is one that I recommended to World Future Society, and we've been chatting about this too. You see, if you want to look into the future of where we're going, the less encumbered you are by our prejudices, the more accurately you can look ahead. The less encumbered you are by racial backgrounds and our politics and our beliefs. One's vision this way is no longer blurred by human passion or by preferences, intolerances, hopes, fears. On that subject, Gann insists this, hear this. Any human futurist who cannot view with equal equanimity the Ayatollah Khomeini's relationship with Allah and Jimmy Carter's friendship with Jesus should probably consider bricklaying. Ditto anyone who thinks in terms of free world or slave world, or uses those words, or Sikhism is good or communism is bad, or sees any single human belief system as truth. And you cannot do that progressing through again. As I said, I have some friends who are doing this, and they're writing me very interesting letters. I'll close now by describing how and why and where I first met Gann. It happened 4 years ago when I was surprised to find myself selected to receive the American Freedom Award. And this was done at the National Space Club at their annual Goddard Memorial Dinner. And I was told I would be expected to make like 20 minutes worth of remarks. And I was a bit nervous at this because the people present at those things, and at this one was the Secretary of State and of Defense, and the head of the Air Force, and senators and generals, and hard-minded people that you really don't want to get up and make an ass of yourself, if possible, in front of them. And so I was shocked into absolute fear when they finally told me that the award had only been given two times before and had been received by Bob Hope and Walter Cronkite. How would you like that? I was thinking of everything. I was thinking of sending a telegram that I'd been struck down by a mysterious tropical disease. And I was so desperate that I decided that I would try something that just isn't done at affairs like this. I thought, if you're going to do something, you better do your thing, man. And so that evening, when I was called to the platform and received it, and the Marine Corps band had played their numbers and had marched off, why, I announced to this audience that all that I had with me were some excerpts from a diary of an extraterrestrial who had lived among us here on this planet, and I would read some excerpts to them. This did not produce wild applause. But as I read, the audience got quieter and quieter. I remember thinking, you don't have to be this damn polite. But I realized that wasn't it. What I began to realize is audiences in Washington are like audiences everywhere else. That we humans can actually identify with an extraterrestrial more rapidly than we identify with each other. And there's a very good reason for that. Hasn't everyone here felt at one time or another that you were somehow plopped down here amidst strangers, and you spend almost your whole life trying to make contact with them? And if you're very, very fortunate, you make contact with a few of them and you make a couple of friends in your life. And this is why Spock did so well, and this is some of the fun of Gann. I'll read you only a short passage from that alien's diary, in which I first heard a scattering of applause from this very tough audience. My alien, who was eventually to become Gann, was saying this to us. He said, I felt my first hint of affection for humans as I heard them demonstrate their skill at music, in which sometimes 100 or more of them will join together in symphonic oneness. And it is difficult not to be optimistic about them as one listens to such loveliness and then realizes it is being performed by creatures still racked by brutish needs to survive and to reproduce, whose awkward animal bodies still retain the fangs and the claws of their savage beginnings. Despite what seems sometimes insurmountable evidence to the contrary, I am now inclined to believe that they will ultimately survive. And I think the best indication of how Gann comes to think of us in the book was in the final sentence presented to that Washington group. In fact, Gann has said it's okay that if I dedicate it to those of you who are at this convention now, as he says this, I look forward to the day
when these humans, who are so much more than they yet believe they are, would at last understand that the cosmos outside and the cosmos inside are one and the same. Thank you for having me here with you.
I promise to do some questions, so that's very kind. Yes, first question. Thank you. Very kind. I like that. I'll tell you what my first question was. My first question was a question worthy of this empire. It was, how would you like a whiskey and soda? And I said, yes. You're very kind. Our time has passed, but let's do some questions and we can continue on tomorrow. And incidentally, don't be afraid of asking me a difficult question. I can handle them. Because if I don't know the answer, I'm a writer. I'll simply make them up. who's got the first one? Got a volunteer, right there. Stand up and shout it out, will you?
I think I better come down there.
I come.
Have you ever considered the use of role-playing games for the creation of characters?
No, I've never done the role-playing game, but it sounds like a great thing to do. Are you a writer? I think that's a marvelous way to do it, yeah. Well, then you can see the power of it. Yeah, really, it's something all of you who like writing should try. Yeah. Right here. In the search for Spock, how did I feel when the Enterprise was destroyed? I felt terrible. Really, I did. But at the same time, you must understand this, once I decided not to... Bless you, Ruby. I told you he was a friend. He's had a heart as big as whales, at least. I felt terrible when it was destroyed, but once I decided not to exercise my option to write and produce these, and the reason I did, as I told some of you, is because I don't want to be a child of Star Trek all my life. I've got other things I want to do, GANs and other things. I couldn't bring in a producer and say, don't do anything without my permission. So if you bring in good people, you have to allow them to have their way of it. My feeling is they will not keep the Enterprise permanently destroyed. How they'll give you a feeling that you've got the old Enterprise back, I don't know, but I know they will be working terribly hard on this. They've got several reasons to do this. As some of you know, the model of the USS Enterprise, this goes back to something I was saying about art and science have to work together. In the Smithsonian Institution, along with the Wright Brothers airplane and the Spirit of St. Louis and all this, hangs the 11-foot television model of the USS Enterprise. And it hung there as a tribute, not to me, not to my genius, although my mother doesn't believe that. But it's hung there as a tribute to the fact that art always goes out there first and science follows. But they're not going to destroy things like that. Paramount knows the value of money far too much they'll realize they do not have a USS fiberglass hanging there. It is the Enterprise, and they'll bring the Enterprise back. I feel confident about that. Yes, shout it out.
Where did the original shape and design of the Enterprise come from?
Did the design of the Enterprise came in a sort of a strange way? I said to my art designer, he came over and he says, well, I'm ready to start on the spaceship, and what does it look like? And I said, I really don't know, but you start sketching and bring the sketches in, and I'll tell you when you're coming close to it. And this art designer later quit. But during that time, I had begun to bring in bright young people, realizing Star Trek was going to be a deadly difficult thing to do, who had things to prove. And Matt Jeffries came in, and he was he had aircraft engineering experience as well as being a fine artist. And one day he brought in something close to what we've got. And in the book, The Making of Star Trek, you can see how it progressed to then. I don't recommend it as a way to build actual aircraft spaceships, but it did work, and everyone liked it. I love the old Enterprise. You people have a strong tradition of ships and love for ships, and I share it with you. Right here. How did I feel when the real Enterprise rolled out? I'll tell you. It was an incredible feeling. I was sitting there with all of the cast, and I think the only one missing was Bill Shatner, who was on a motion picture back east, and Nimoy and I sat together, and for one thing, Nimoy said, "Do you believe this?" And I said, "No." He says, "Neither do I." And then we watched the head of the Air Force Band raise his baton. And I thought, well, now we're going to hear Star Spangled Banner, America the Beautiful, something like that. I heard the first four notes. And I said to him, I think I'm going crazy. And he said to me, "I don't trust our government." It was a moment. Right here. Can I tell you anything about Star Trek 4? I can only tell you this, that we have spent most of our time... Star Trek has such a breadth of format. You can literally invent the planet and have anything happen, that we spent most of our time talking about things we don't want to do. One of the things we seem to have agreed upon at home is, so we've done three of a series on this particular death planet and so on, and now it's time to go on to something else. We said we don't want it. Certainly, we do not want this is entirely a shipboard story. We want to go out. We want to meet some different people. We also chatted. One of the people said, "I've always thought that some of the going to different places in time have been interesting, like City on the Edge of Forever and so on." And we decided, yes, let's consider that seriously. And that's really as far as we've got. It's an exciting and scary script stage to be in. Is where we are now. I think Leonard Nimoy will definitely direct the next one, the basis of what he will do. Yes, sir.
This may be sort of a cold, blimey question, but with all the techniques you had on the Enterprise, did you personally dispense with the seatbelt?
What I did on that is an example of a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. I realized that in space, your ship's not going to get rocked around by near misses of explosive things and so on. And knowing we had all of those things, I said, "We don't need it. You're going to be sitting there like your living room all the time." And indeed, our first film, we had the first one in which we had an enemy vessel shooting something that exploded near us. I just had my people sitting here. In a vacuum, explosion transmits no impulse to the ship. And the film just lay there and died. Near hit, everyone is sitting. Like I was saying earlier, you've got a 20th century audience. And so I called in our scientific advisor, which we had from the very first, and I said, "You've got to help us. You've got to help us, because it is dying this way." And he thought for a while, and he says, "I think if you had sufficient light could import a shock so that you could jiggle your camera and show the people around." And thus was born the photon torpedo. And that's how it began. And this happened to us many times. We also did some things that are wrong, obviously wrong, but you reach a point, you must make a judgment on whether you have the adventure, excitement, and fun, or whether you're going to be so cold-bloodedly science is no fun at all. So the trick is to catch a little in between. Right here. Huh? What do we do? What? How do we develop the optical?
How are you developing any films?
Oh, am I developing any films now? I have a comedy written from Eric Knight's book, The Flying Yorkshireman, which I would love to do. But American film is in a strange comedy time. It's got to be outrageously, outlandishly funny. As the head of Columbia Pictures said to me, we're in a phase where you have to paste chicken feathers on the people or they don't believe you have comedy. And so, and the Flying Yorkshireman, he also wrote Lassie Come Home, marvelous writer. It's a quiet, fun comedy, and I just have to wait till the right time. Meanwhile, I'm looking at Philip Wiley's Disappearance, which has one day due to strange things that happen, plus about negatives and positives in the universe, we're all sitting there, and blink, all the women disappear. And we go on and we tell a bit of a story. Tell a bit of a story. Vacuum cleaners are sitting there going, you know, and male babies are squalling with no one to change them. There's a nice little scene in the real book. There's a man and a woman making love. And suddenly he finds himself facing the floor. Wonder what has happened? And then the fun of it is that we go on for a while and then we come back to that particular day and we see it from the women's point of view. All the men have disappeared. And what makes it kind of fun to think about is we have reached a time, and film and television has reached a time, where we can talk about sex and talk about it intelligently, not purely pornographic, but human love, what it means. You can even get in, we've reached a time now, you can even get into the question of what are we to each other? Are we two halves of something that's great and we don't understand it? And you can talk about would men switch to men and women to women? And what are the pros and cons of this sort of thing? And I think we've reached a time of adulthood when we can take an honest look at sex and what a wonderful and exciting thing it is and do a film. And that kind of attracts me. Although I know this, I will have to get myself a practicing female as a writer, because I think I'm a good writer, but one of the things I've always been disappointed at is I cannot yet put myself in the mind and soul of a woman, and I think a script like this needs that. I don't want to give you the male's view of how women think. So kind of a fun project. Writing is fun. Wow, and they pay you for it. Mixed feelings. I thought it was an exciting film. There was far too much violence in it for me. I think with a little cleverness they could have gotten action and adventure. And I thought Khan was not as really as good a Khan as the one we had in the television. Because he had evils and goods. He had strengths and weaknesses. Whereas this Khan was, I will chase you through the halls of Ganymede and so on. But it worked. And the reason it worked, of course, is they got this incredible actor, Ricardo Montalban, to do it, and he made it come alive and work. Had they gotten a lesser actor, you might have been tittering then. So they pulled it off. But I would like to see it done with a little less emphasis on violence and on military themes and things like this. The director of that one was demanding that all our actors salute each other when they come on the bridge. And our actors, thank God, said, no, hey, man, we don't do that. Right back here. Oh yeah, yes. I think getting the Romulan cloaking device is sort of something you wish you hadn't done. Really. I remember early in the series it occurred to me to an event like that. Thank God, if we've got telescopes today and TV systems and so on, we can certainly look and have a good look at where we're beaming down. Right? But I just never mentioned it to anyone, because that would have really fouled up a lot of stories where you beam down and get surprised. And that's part of what we were talking about. You sometimes just can't be scientifically accurate in everything. What you want to be accurate in, and the whole point of literature and art, is you want to be accurate in making a statement. Art, whether you're doing TV, or Rembrandt, or opera, sculpturing, whatever it is. The whole point of art is to make a statement to you, an alternate reality for you to consider. That's why the artist is important. The artist is not just a nice thing to have around if you've got plenty of money. Artist is as basic as the scientist. It has been since the beginning of time, when the artist was the tribal memory with his sons and so on. How did I get on that? Well, my subject of it.
Can you tell us your opinion about the search for Spock? What did you think?
I thought the search for Spock was a good film. I thought it was coming closer to what Star Trek was, and I think it shows the way to come even closer now. There were some things I would have liked changed, but again, I can't. If I'm going to produce, I should get out and produce, and if I'm not going to, I should be there encouraging them to do better and better. And I think the next one will be another step further toward a truly exciting, real Star Trek. Okay. The question was, in the series we used it to make points that were relative to that time, and what points would we be now making in the 80s? I think that certainly sexual equality would be a fully established thing, rather than having thrown out the woman who was second in command as they did. I hope you forgive me, because when I had the choice between keeping Majo on as number one and Mr. Spock, I knew I needed an alien. I figured I couldn't win both fights. And so I kept Leonard and married her. In those days, I could not have done it the other way around, anyway. I doubt Leonard would have given me a 10-year-old son. I knew what I was doing. But today, I would be talking about alternate sexual choices, too. And we'd be probably doing some time stories or something, getting back to the problem we face with armaments building up. I think I would get much more deeply into the choices an individual has. Like my family, we have decided that we can no longer stay seated at a dinner, no matter how much we love the hostess, if they permit someone there who talks intolerance. The niggers are ruining us. The Jews have all the money, or whatever the intolerance is. We simply will not stay. We politely excuse ourselves. We hate to do that, but we feel that if everyone who feels the way we feel will take it upon themselves, a resolve to refuse to sit still for such nonsense, we'll see much less of such nonsense in the world. I think that's part of the fight we have to take. I think I would also be talking about the fact that there comes a time when people have to go out on the streets with their beliefs. Our ancestors did it many times. There is going to come a time that we're going to have to do it. I certainly would be talking about the time that happened when some citizens began to decide that they were citizens of the planet, and that an accidental, geographical accident of birth gives no group of people the right to own your soul and force you to contend against others, or say, here's an invisible line called a border and you can't pass it. Or if you do, we get to look into your undies and things like that. And this is going to be a huge battle. We have, and most of you here will be involved in that battle. You're going to have to make some decisions on it, because governments will react. Even the governments we have in love are going to react very strongly against this. And you're going to find your friends hating you if you refuse to be a good Briton or a good American or a good whatever. It's a fire banana. So there are all sorts of exciting subjects now to talk about and in the future. It's great fun to do, too. And people say, do you mean to say, what right did you have? Do you mean to say that you sat there and you propagandized a whole world, a whole nation? Hey, you're goddamn right. That's what artists do. That's what we're supposed to do. Because the next artist has every right in the world to come along and say, he's crazy, here's how I see it. And the next one, here's how I see it. And that's how we get the rich variety of opinion. That is diversity in action. All right, a couple more questions and we'll go. Okay, way back, can you shout it so I can hear it?
Why do you name Fox on the planet?
Actually, it was just a temporary sort of name, Vulcan, which I didn't really like because Flash Gordon had some Vulcan people in it. But you put on these temporary names and you get busy, more pressing fights come up, and they just sort of happen and go along. One thing I was happy I did, when I first laid out Mr. Spock, why, I had him from Mars. And then I got to thinking, look, they may get up there while I'm doing this. And you find out it isn't so. So then we jumped out to Vulcan. Also, the striped man, the striped shirt back there, just one other thing. It may interest you to know that one of the reasons for Mr. Spock looking like he does is I had a theory that if someone looked a bit satanic, the ladies might like him a little better. I make no statement, but I noticed as a teenager dating girls, if the mother said, "I like that Gene Roddenberry," I never had a chance with a girl. And I say it's only a theory, but it did seem to work. Question.
After seeing, not a lot. I'm used to the microphone anyway. After seeing Star Trek 3 and talking to fans about it, I think the general opinion is that Robin Curtis was pretty cacatobic. I just wondered if there's any chance of getting Kirstie Alley back. I think, yes, I've got a few fans. If not Kirstie Alley, how about Helen Slater?
I must be frank and say that I like the new girl that's there, but I did like Kirstie too. I thought she had a spirit, but it's a difficult thing for me to comment on. I just assume you didn't list my comments in your publications here because this is a nice girl and a nice actress, and I am not going to intrude again on the producer. That is the producer's choice. I have told them that I will. If they break any of our basic commandments about affection for life forms and tolerance and all of that, I then will hold a press conference and say I'm withdrawing my name from this Star Trek. But I said I really will not do it for trivial reasons like costume and casting and that sort of thing. I've got to hold that ace in the hole for something really powerful, something really believable. Well, I have one nice question and we'll... I like the. How do I like the value they put on friendship? Indeed, I do. I think it's powerful, and I hope they do keep it. Love, affection, friendship. Wow, it's a nice commodity, and you can get it very inexpensively. Still, listen again. I thank you for inviting Majel and I, Spock, Gann, Rupert, all of us here. We enjoyed being here. Thank you.
Waiting 8 years of guests for. Yes. Absolutely. Now, just one minor detail here. Could you all stay seated except for the stewards who offered to sell the stuff for Majel? Would they please go into the foyer now to see Leslie? Will the rest of you just wait for a moment while Leslie gets them organised and sorted out? Majel's stuff has come through. It will be sold later on, but can we just get that organised before there's a mass exodus? So would the stewards who volunteered to help, could they now slide out ahead of everybody else and go and see Leslie?